Nothing's certain in politics, but professionals know one thing. Subscribing to the Cook Political Report is the right decision in every election cycle.
For more than four decades, the Cook Political Report has been providing political professionals with the right analysis to help them invest political capital with confidence.
A deep knowledge of the past, combined with a meticulous, unbiased analysis of the present, produces the most accurate predictions of the future, time and time again.
Because it's all backed by data from every input that decides elections for president, Congress, and governorships.
Subscribers to the Cook Political Report get the clarity they need through smart analysis that you won't get anywhere else.
Like the very latest outlook for every race and access to our analysts. Amy Walter, David Wasserman, Carrie Dan, Jessica Taylor, Aaron Covey, and Matthew Klein.
The Cook Political Report offers
the right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
For getting it right.
Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe.
Hello, welcome to The Onyears. I'm Amy Walter. Back in 2023, Republican pollster Patrick Graffini wrote a book that laid out a path for how the party could win future elections with a working-class, multiracial coalition. Later that year, I talked with Patrick on this very podcast, you can go back and listen to it even, where we discussed whether Trump could expand his base to include those voters of color. Well, as we saw, he did. In fact, in 2016, the coalition that elected Trump was 88% white. By 2024, it was down to just 78% white. So I wanted to have Patrick Graffini back on for a conversation about how well that same coalition is holding up 6 months into Trump 2.0. Whether these voters will show up for Republicans in 2026 and whether the next Republican nominee for president will have a similar appeal to these voters. Patrick is also a partner and pollster for Echelon Insights. He writes a great Substack, The Intersection. Also, just a quick programming note, we are taking a bit of a summer break in August, but never fear, we'll be back in September with new episodes of The Odd Years. Here's our conversation.
Patrick Graffini, thank you for joining me. Really appreciate this.
Thank you, Amy, for having me.
So the last time we spoke on this very podcast was back in December of 2023. You had just come out with your book, Party of the People Inside the Multiracial Populist Coalition Remaking the GOP. We talked a lot about, well, could this be 2024, the year where Republicans really cracked the code on this coalition? Turned out that you were quite prescient. And it wasn't just an idea you had. You actually had data and analysis to back it up. But the big question many of us have, and I'm sure you may also be thinking a lot about, is where the coalition goes from here, post-2024. So the first thing I wanted to ask you was, 6 months into Trump 2.0, how do we think this multiracial coalition is holding together? And what do we think they are thinking about the president and his policies?
So I think it's a tricky question to answer, right? Because we have, in American elections, we just have this moment of truth every 2 or 4 years. And we have the hard data. And I think what makes it a little challenging is that, yes, we have polls in the interim, but this realignment has really happened really among the most disengaged voters in the country, which means could be very easily undone. Now, would I say it's being undone in any sense? I actually wouldn't. If you look at the Latino Trump voter, the multiracial Trump voter, and you really study them closely, you know, has their approval of Trump really declined inordinately, right? Not really seeing that yet, but still a lot of game left to play. I also think midterms, right? I mean, in this political climate culture right now, it's not like these voters are engaged in these debates, right that are happening in the off year, right? So, I would say, look, when we get closer to the election, I think we certainly have a better sense. But this is not necessarily the voter we're used to tracking in a midterm. It's not the voter we're used to tracking for these special elections that everybody, you know, kind of politicos obsess about. And sometimes I wrote in my book at one point, the only way you know they exist is in actual election results.
On election day.
Yeah.
Like literally on election day.
And this is uniquely true among amongst these voters. From the polling evidence we have, though, I don't see a ton. With that said, I think, look, I write in my forthcoming, I will write in my forthcoming paperback epilogue to Party of the People that, look, 2028 really is going to be the moment of truth, because you're going to have a different Republican candidate. And that's really the opportunity for things to actually change up, right, is when you get just people reacting to something different and something completely new on the scene.
I think that is really an important point, this idea of the voter who is not as engaged in politics is a voter that is not typically active in a midterm election or a special election. I think that's right. And so your point is, if we are looking at polling where we see Trump's overall approval rating with Latino voters or younger voters, and we say, oh, well, it's lower now, his approval rating, than his 2024 showing, that's not necessarily telling us all that much about whether this coalition that he put together in 2024 is fraying, because we don't, those voters who are in that sample are probably the kind of people that show up in every election, not the kind of voters who are more disengaged. Is that fair to say that we're not necessarily polling the very people? It's hard to poll the very people who make up this coalition.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, there's a real question, right? I think the challenge for Republicans is going to be, is that voter going to show up? How do you make that voter show up? Particularly your specific half of segment of that electorate. How do you make them show up in an environment where, midterms are really determined a lot by turnout? You're going to have more college-educated voters in a midterm. You're going to have more high-propensity voters in a midterm. You're going to have older voters. All areas where Democrats should be doing better, right, than they are. But that said, you know, they do seem to have, and if you just look purely at the averages, not just speculating, they do seem to have a generic ballot lead. But it's much lower than it was in 2005. It's much lower than it was in 2017. I think we're seeing kind of this question develop of, is this now different? Because, I think it's pretty clear from, Trump's approval, right, while it has declined since the inauguration, right, it's a question of has there been any kind of a break or true break in his support like we saw with Joe Biden? Like we saw with, voters who had just decided he's too old, he shouldn't run again. Many people in his coalition had decided that, and that was really tough. Versus Trump has so many dimensions to him, right? So many different ways for people to kind of register approval that you could say, I don't like this action or that action. I don't like his personality. I don't like his tweets. I don't like this, but I like the policies in general. I like the direction. I like the style. And I think that there's just so much more dimensionality to Trump in terms of the way people can register approval or disapproval of him, where sometimes one single metric doesn't really capture it as well. You just have a more conventional, person in there like Biden was.
Let's talk about Democrats for a minute as well. Again, looking at these last 6 months, how do you think Democrats have responded to the fact that there has been a realignment and their ability to try to win back some of those voters that they honestly thought were theirs forever?
I think that this is, it's the same. I think we're seeing a repeat to some extent of the dynamic that we saw post 2016. Yeah, question of whether it turned out to be as politically successful as it was then. But I really do think the midterms offer in this particular environment where we are realigning really around, Republicans are now the low propensity party, Democrats seem to be the high propensity party, which is an absolute flip from, where we were in the Obama years. That it's just a fundamentally, this is very much, I think at least in the last couple cycles, has been very much of a presidential cycle problem. Mm. So what I would be concerned about if I were Democrat, is to say, look, we might do well in the midterms potentially, right? I mean, we might get the bump, right? We might get the reaction, right, that you normally get to an incumbent party in a midterm. But that's not going to tell us very much about where we stand with these low propensity voters who are not really even in the midterm electorate, who will swing back and forth pretty aggressively.
Right.
And it didn't tell us much in 2018, right, about the swing among Latinos to Trump in that election. So I think you almost need, you know, I think if you're particularly on the campaign side, because everybody kind of asked me this question, what's the implication, right, of this coalition for 2026? And I'm like, well, you almost need two different units and two different teams of your party. One that's working on your midterm strategy, one that's working on, you know, kind of the long-term state of your coalition and winning the White House. So two can be two very different things.
Right. Well, a lot of Democrats look at what Mamdani had done in New York in the primary, in the Democratic primary, where he won in these multiracial working class areas of New York with a very progressive message, but one in which he was focused relentlessly on this issue of affordability, right? And so Democrats look at that and they say, oh, see, that's how we get these voters back. We focus on cost. We focus on the economy. That's how we lost them in 2024. We win them back on the economy. Is it that simple, Patrick?
No, it's not. So there's a few things about that, right? I mean, a couple of, I think people have done the kind of analyses where you look at, like, did an area swing to Trump versus did, you know, how did Mamdani do? There's actually no correlation between the two. I mean, people like to say that it kind of held up pretty well, right, in those areas, but it wasn't like, you know, it was specifically those voters who shifted to Trump. You had some, you probably had Trump voters, or some Trump like leaning areas, right, or areas that leaned to Trump or were moving to Trump. But it seems to me there's two things going on, right, that the voters left behind in the Democratic primary are much more liberal, right, as you see this exodus of moderate voters from the party, that these moderate non-white working class voters, they're not really voting in the Democratic primary anymore, right? I mean, they may be the low propensity voters who just never voted in primaries to begin with. And so, you know, they weren't really measured by this, right? This primary specifically. You had, I think, Nate Cohn published a stat that was only 6% of the Democratic primary electorate in New York City voted for Trump in 2024. About like maybe half of them were Orthodox Jewish voters, which, as you know, is like a very, very idiosyncratic voting block that will vote 100% for a candidate of one party and 100% for a candidate of the other party based on kind of their interests and, you know, where they see their interests lying. So I think there's two things. That said, I think, well, I will say one thing for this. I think the manner and the style and the affect, particularly in these urban areas, of the sort of young, progressive candidate, as opposed to, let's say, that upscale liberal candidate who generally, you know, it feels like national Democrats have found themselves appealing to, I think can cut through. And the same way Bernie, I think, cuts through where other Democrats can't, where these more sort of establishment Democrats who are, you know, kind of focused on these cultural issues in response to the changes in their base. But somebody who does represent that focus on economic issues, I think can, right, build a coalition that goes outside just the hardcore progressive base. The problem is, I think if you see a little bit of reversion in that, I think the problem is, and this is like the AOC style of politics, is the Bernie style of politics, the problem then becomes the suburbs. Right. Because I think they'll respond again. I think and you don't obviously have suburbs. You have places that maybe look like suburbs in New York City, is you may see a reversion, right, back to a little bit of the old coalitions. If you actually saw an AOC make it through a primary, right, because there is still a big electability question that, yes, I think to some extent there's kind of a local maximum to be reached in a Democratic primary by moving left. But the question is, some of these voters who are outside that immediate Democratic primary electorate, how do they respond to something like this?
I know. And that, to me, is really a fascinating question. Again, going to 2028, what are Democratic primary voters looking for? And it was pretty clear Patrick, by the time we hit 2019, it was pretty clear that what Democrats really wanted at the core was somebody to beat Trump, right? That was the sort of driving issue at the bottom of it all. Now it feels as if where Democrats sit today is they've got to figure out not so much how to beat Trump, but how to find their way. Who are they? What do they stand for? How do they win over these voters who are not simply engaged just on whether you like or don't like Donald Trump? And how they do that and who's best at doing that is the real challenge. What do you see as you watch, as you're watching these different Democratic candidates, all of whom hope to be president in 2028, scour the country and, you know, go on podcasts and get on national television?
I mean, everyone, like I said, like once you get into primary fields that are potentially 20 people,
yeah,
and you literally have a test of every possible flavor, right? I mean, we saw this, like, I mean, the explosion of primary fields and the explosion of people, you know, perhaps in response to Trump saying, you know, anyone can do this, right? You know, it's possible to actually come out of nowhere and win a nomination. And you see this just kind of explosion of different political theories, which is very interesting. And that's like going to be a test, right? Of really, you know, where are the different currents in the party? With that said, I do think, right, that the AOC, right, I expect her to be strong, right, in this primary, because I feel like, you know, she would have the progressive lane cornered, right, where you, as you have multiple kind of potentially more normie establishment type Democrats, right? And I expect, right, I expect her to be able to raise a lot of money from low dollar donors. I expect her, in fact, to dominate in that corner of the primary. And the question is, all right, does the field consolidate? And you don't really have, you know, the potential, right? You know, particularly if Harris doesn't run, right? You know, you sort of have a potential for a free-for-all, really, on that side of the party. So I think that they'll press that theory, right? Because she is somebody who, in her own district, has won. You know, there is the AOC Trump voter in her district. I think she'll have a story. She'll have a story about, you know, how the fact that, you know, particularly the Bernie style, you know, Bernie seems to be pretty popular in this podcast set, right? And can she inherit a lot of that support?
Right.
The real test for this progressive Democratic bloc, I think, is there any kind of moderation, anything they're offering on cultural issues? I know they're dialing up the economic rhetoric.
Yeah.
They're dialing it up in potentially a way that's problematic, right, to some other parts of their coalition, but the new members of their coalition in the suburbs. So, and that might work, right, to dial up. The question is that enough to compensate? You know, are they moving at all on their cultural positioning? Which, right, as we see, I think is, you know, from the last few elections, is what these low propensity voters are responding to. They're not following the economic policy debates as much. It's not about policy for them. It's about performance, more so on those economic questions. So, number one, how is the Republican Party under Trump seen as performing on the economy 2 and 4 years hence? But number two is, like, you know, what can Democrats seriously offer in terms of concessions on some of these cultural debates to really seriously narrow and recast the image of their party?
Right. And that is really such an important point, which really leads me directly to my next question, which is this idea of who these low propensity voters are, what we know about them. And I really wanted to get you to help us understand how you find them and how we know how and what they're thinking. And so I was reading the other day, thanks to your Substack, which recommends a lot of great reads, the data guys over at the Washington Post found that voters of color who watch television, they're doing really well with those voters, about the same as they always have. It's those voters who follow the election, not on TV, but get all their information from, say, YouTube or, you know, other non-TV linear sources. That's where Democrats really failed with voters of color. And so the answer to many Democratic problems, you've seen I'm sure, and heard a lot about it is, okay, well, we just got to get on YouTube. We got to have our own Joe Rogan. That's how we solve our problem with these low propensity voters. What do you think of when you think of a low propensity voter, how to find them, what they're interested in, and how to talk to them?
I mean, look, I think that this has been the pattern all going back to this rise of new media and the internet, right, where it's less about, you know, in terms of staking out your political brand. It's less about, you know, here I am saying things that are, you know, broadly acceptable to the mainstream of America and saying things that are relatively popular that I can then penetrate through TV with an audience that represents a broad cross section of the mainstream right. of America and win people over that way. That model no longer works. That's a politics of, you know, there's all these niches, right? We saw it discussed the importance of, right, of niches in this Democratic primary and any kind of open primary where everyone really is, you know, or really targeting a specific niche, hoping to blow that up, make that bigger. But, you know, I think fragmented media environment means that, you know, there's opportunity for people to just exploit those niches in a way that really crowds out anyone who seems like a vanilla establishment type person, right? That just nobody wants to follow them. Nobody cares. Nobody's interested, right? Until very, very late in the process when people kind of start to return to that question of who can win the general election. So the dynamics have changed. But look, I think that doing that in the absence of, and you know, I've been through these cycles with Republicans in the Obama era, where there's a lot of talk, right, in the Obama era of, you know, how are Republicans going to get smart on the internet? How are they going to get smart on digital? And it's like, yeah, I think there's a lot of things tactically, right? And there are seeds, I think, in that period that were laid down in terms of things that grew into. But it really took the emergence of Donald Trump.
100%.
Right? The personality, yep. larger than life personality for people to rally behind. And then everything starts to fall into place. I don't think this idea, right, Democrats are going to spend $20 million studying men, right? Independent of having a candidate who can actually speak to men, I think that is, you know, a little bit silly.
A quick break, and we'll be back with Patrick Ruffini.
Did you know the Cook Political Report has a free weekly newsletter? It's called In Brief. Stay up to date on off-year elections, next year's midterms, race rating changes, analysis of the national political environment, and so much more. The link to subscribe to In Brief is in our show notes. It's easy and free. Where you go and find these voters is becoming the new coin of the realm for presidential campaigns, right? In a diffused media environment, in a time where people are in their little niches, how do you as a campaign figure out where these people are and how to meet them where they are?
Right. And I think it takes like really listening to people who are really outside of the normal political channels. You know, as you're and get really getting fresh blood in there. I mean, no candidate is going to be a well-versed personally, right? In every single new podcast, right? Every single, nor would I really want them to be. I mean, the closest thing we've ever had to that is Donald Trump. So where he is an information omnivore and he, you know, he really understood, right, really early on. I mean, his intuition was, you know, how do I get the, you know, media and kind of Fox News viewer on my side, because in many ways he was the media and Fox News viewer in terms of, you know, how he responds to the things he's seeing on television. Right. And so he's very authentic in that way. But when it came to 2024, he needed to rely on his son, right, to tell him like, oh, no, the Theo Vaughn is really big. And I think for Democrats, right, I mean, part of this challenge has been, I think for Democrats, is they've been stuck with, I think, the same kind of professional consultant class that is advising and talking see the candidates and the way you see the coverage about how they're interfacing with the podcasters who are trying to interview them and start trying to control the output, right, of the product in a very traditional way. I just think that that is the methodology, right? It's all wrong in terms of how they're going about it, even if there were some corners of the campaign, right, that were agitating for, and I don't doubt that there were some, but the idea you're going to go on Rogan, but you're only going to do an hour. We don't want to talk about this thing with the subway guy. I mean, all of this stuff, which didn't mesh well, that sort of conventional, cautious political thinking.
Right. Which suggests, going back to the AOC point, which suggests that her ability to really authentically live in those spaces gives her an incredible advantage early on in if she decides that she wants to run in 2028. I guess that begs the question of, are we going to see Democrats going down the same path or a similar path that we saw Republicans go down in 2016, where they said, look, we've kind of done the traditional Republican path. We've listened to the experts and the Washington, D.C. pundit class telling us that we need to vote for these sort of middle of the road John McCain's and Mitt Romney's. And that didn't really get us anywhere. So what have we got to lose? Let's go out and take a flyer on this guy, Trump. And if he loses, so what? We lost with the folks that were supposed to be the ones who were going to deliver us the middle of the electorate and never did.
I think there's a high chance of that. And I think that the attitudes of the primary election, I mean, I just think that you've seen just a sea change of attitudes after this election, right? Where it's always the election in which, I mean, I think the idea of somebody winning is unthinkable and then they win, right? I think is always that election that always prompts a little bit of rethinking, right? I mean, I think there was probably, like, go back to 2008, there was probably a sense on the Republican side, like, yeah, this is probably kind of hopeless after a certain point, going up against Obama. But there was a sense, right, in the Republican Party, I was there, like, oh, we can really beat Obama the second time because the economy's right? not doing well.
The economy's right? bad, I mean, right.
Economy's bad, polling close, all this stuff. And, you know, I think there was a lot of Kool-Aid drinking at that time. But what that did do, I think, was create the opportunity for people to say, no, this was such a failure. I mean, of a lot of introspection for people to really turn against the conventional strategies. And I think in many ways, like the idea of, oh, we're going to nominate and elect a felon, right? I mean, that's what Democrats were saying to themselves, even. And yeah, we did the candidate switch, so that wouldn't happen. And yeah, that hopefully solved that age issue, right? I mean, going into the election, you had a lot of Democrats saying, oh, of course, you know, we're not going to elect somebody like Trump again. I mean, that's a totally crazy idea. And the fact that then you wake up the morning after the election really shocked in disbelief really does prompt a lot of people. And so I think, like, you know, the question, you know, I think is, okay, they can go in a more moderate direction. It's probably the safer direction. They can go in an AOC direction, which I think in many ways is going to be more emotionally, what's going to be most emotionally satisfying, Josh Shapiro right. or AOC? It's going to be AOC, right? And then the question is, can she walk back? You know, is she nimble enough to walk back some of her old positions to get people, enough people to believe, oh, she doesn't really believe the stuff she believed before? Just like Trump was able to do, right? Trump was able to do, I think reposition himself pretty effectively because I think people wanted to believe, right? People liked him, wanted to believe. People liked Obama, wanted to believe in him. And you win voters that you shouldn't. You start winning voters that you shouldn't be winning. And so I think like there will be that model, right? But whereas everything, all the data, I would say all the data suggests Democrats really have to do something on these cultural issues. But nothing that I've seen really shows any kind of inclination that they're going to. So what's the alternative?
Yeah, tell me what you mean by do something. What would that look like?
Right. I mean, I think it's the cliche, but it's the sister soldier moment. It's the sense of, okay, yes, this is something where I am positioning myself as very different from the rest of the Democratic Party on this issue, stylistically,
which makes it really hard to believe that someone like AOC is going to be able to say, right, whether it's on ICE or defund the police, any of those issues, that she's going to be able to effectively or realistically, authentically take a different position. It seems like she's going to have to actually lean more into it, right?
Yeah. And the model is someone like Fetterman, right, who does do those things, but is nowhere, right, for a lot of reasons. I mean, people really doubt his viability, right?
Yep.
Mentally and physically, right? You've got a lot of sniping in him. But I would say, like, that is somebody who is effectively positioned, would be effectively positioned just from a pure issue standpoint, regardless of his profile, right? His aesthetic is great, right, for the kinds of voters. But again, he doesn't seem to be going anywhere. I think Bernie 2016, in a way, was this that type of candidate where, you know, it's not so much that, okay, I need, maybe I don't necessarily need, far be it for me to give advice to Democrats, by the way, but it's not so much that they need to be, okay, go hard right on some of these issues in a way that just you're constantly pissing off your base. But it's either just giving that sense to the media and voter, like, I don't really care that much. I'm not about this issue.
Right.
Like, I'm about the economy.
I mean, that's kind of what Mom Donnie is trying to do right now, which is like, I know I tweeted all that stuff and I said all that stuff about Intifada and whatever, but like,
And it's like really authentically saying, like, I don't really spend any time talking about it. And I think he effectively conveyed, like, you know, he had positions, Bernie had positions on guns that were far away from the Democratic mainstream, right? I think it's, but 2020 was different. I think he was pressured a little bit by, some of the cultural left in the campaign to be more forward on racial issues, because the understanding then is the more left you go on racial issues, the more you're going to get done poorly with African Americans the first time. That turns out to be incorrect, by the way. So I think maybe unlearning those lessons from Bernie 2020 and going back to a Bernie 2016 style campaign might be the ticket, but it's hard to see it, right? It's hard to see exactly how you get from point A to point B.
And of course, the big test will also be on the Republican side. And so thinking there, Patrick, as you're saying, you're thinking short term and long term about engaging this coalition, thinking about the potential 2028ers, somebody like J.D. Vance, somebody like Marco Rubio, obviously you've got Josh Hawley, all these other folks who are sort of positioning themselves as the rightful heirs of this coalition. Tell me how you sort of see the Republican field lining up those voters in a way similarly to how Trump did it.
I mean, so look, I think the reality is that as long as Trump remains very popular within the Republican base, that his anointed vice president is probably in a pretty good position.
Yep.
If he becomes unpopular, right? If the problems he's having with the Jeffrey Epstein situation start to multiply and you actually start to see many more examples of him kind of at crosswise with the base, then that maybe creates an opening for something new. But, you know, historically, right, the popular, let's say popular with the base incumbent usually can get his VP, or the VP is very well positioned. That said, this likelihood someone's going to rise up from the field. Maybe someone we're not necessarily thinking about. I think you're right. It's an opportunity, right, for a reset. And so I think, like, if you're a Democrat or for a Republican, I mean, the idea is, I think we've had this, like, sort of continuity in these trends, and these trends have lasted over the last several election cycles because you really had one person who the entirety of politics has revolved around.
Exactly. For 8 years, this is, right, and one person.
Which is 12 years, right? One person. And you normally don't get that for more than two elections. Like, we've had it for three. Yep. So we've had these very sticky things. There's the opportunity, right, for something different that we can't necessarily predict coming up in 2028. It's not going to be a straight line, one thing or the other. But the one thing I would note, I think you mentioned that Washington Post article. The one thing I would say, right, is that they took a look, right, at where the realignment was going in Canada, in the UK, right, in non-white precincts in those areas too. And, you know, they don't have a Donald Trump in those countries, and they had also moved right. So there's something that seemed deeper going on here.
The other question for you, Patrick, is whether you think of this as a Trump coalition, or this is just the new swing voter, right? That this, I mean, in your book, you talked about it as, look, this multiracial populist coalition is going to be the new swing vote. Do you still see it that way?
Absolutely. There's always mm-hmm. that possibility of swinging back and forth. Hispanics in particular have been mm-hmm. a very, very swingy electorate. We had Republicans do well under George W. Bush, and then that changed. You had Barack mm-hmm. Obama emerge, and you had the sort of personality contrast, the force of personality really rallied younger voters, these younger rising voting blocks behind the Democratic candidate. And I think in many ways, he was able to transcend what were the partisan kind of camps. And the question is, who is able to be sort of transcendent in that same way, that even if you have an AOC who I think on paper kind of can demographically represent people, is she still bound or is she her own inclination still to reinforce some of those existing divisions on cultural issues? It's something we just discussed. But, you know, in particular, I do think Republicans better watch out, because this swing vote can shift, right? This is a low propensity voter. Can shift. I think that there is, it's high risk. It's the high risk, high reward voter. And it's high risk, high reward from a persuasion standpoint, that we really have a good fix, I think, on where it just happens to be that the decisive swing voting block in this election happens to be both the voter who is, unsure about whether they'll vote or not. So they're harder to measure in polls. They're just, difficult to get them to pick up a phone, and as well, very swingy, based on changes in political dynamics, political environment. And, the way I would look at it is you have that voter who is really that cost of living voter, the one that Mom Dami really went after, who, I don't really, and that to me is just to give that answer in a poll, say, I care most about the cost of living means. What I don't care about these hot button issues. I don't care about immigration. I don't care about the state of democracy. I don't care about all these things that people in DC are talking about. I just care about what's going on in my own life. And as a result, I'm less anchored to either party. And that means there's the biggest high risk, high reward, right? There's the biggest chance for overperformance if you actually really intentionally talk to those people. But there's also a kind of a big risk, right, that you, if you don't, you're going to lose them in droves. That's going to obviously be a bigger deal in presidential than a midterm.
Right.
But nonetheless, I think it's something that we overlook in our focus on this mythical voter who is both that voter who will turn out in every election, that unicorn voter who will turn out in every election, but is up for grabs.
Right.
And that voter just doesn't exist.
No, maybe they're like 2 or 3% of the electorate, if that.
Right. The thing is, the voter who is going to show up right in a midterm, going to show up in these specials, is going to be that voter who is certain to vote and very highly partisan too, very not movable. And I think, I think there've been rare instances of them moving. Maybe 2016 was one in the suburbs, but like I said, right. I mean, that was less of I became a swing voter, but just a switch flip. they flipped the switch.
Yep.
And they didn't turn out to be very persuadable in the end.
Right. Do you think, speaking of risk reward, that the immigration policy, especially if we do start to see this real increase, deportations, becomes the sort of thing that could move some of these Latinos back into the Democratic camp? In other words, there's always that people who've been in politics for a long time always go back to California, right, and say Pete Wilson really screwed up the opportunity for Republicans to win over Latino voters with, what was it, Prop 187, right? He set in motion what was an alienating event. Do you see that as a potential risk here for Republicans with what we're seeing on the deportation front?
I think to some extent, what you see in the numbers right now is partly Trump has been a victim of his own success in terms of mm-hmm. bringing down those border crossings numbers so much
right.
that people are just prioritizing the issue less. So if he's going to go, you know, if the midterms are going to be about, you can't say there's a migrant caravan heading to the border, right? You can't say that. He stopped them. And that's like policy wins and a policy success that he can rightfully claim.
Yeah, why can't you just run on, I did it. I said I was going to stop. Yeah. I was going to close the border, and I did.
Yeah, the problem is, right, I mean, there's sort of this whole other promise around deportation, right? And, and that's the rub. Now, the question is, I think you've seen evidence of him actually bowing to political reality and being surgical in terms of saying, I'm probably not going to go after these agricultural or hotel workers, right? The flexibility, right, that I think he uniquely has to essentially, at a given moment's notice, say, this is what the goalpost is, right? And to flexibly move the goalposts. I think he has that superpower.
He's always
very,
very good at that. Yes.
Right. And so I think that the idea is he has just a lot more flexibility in terms of he doesn't have to go as hardcore, right, in order for people, and particularly his base, to believe that he's actually fighting for them, because number one, he's delivered on the border. And so you have a lot fewer swing voters saying, you know, this is a really important issue that I really trust Trump's approach on, because like other aspects of the problem become more important. Are we being more humane with deportations? That now has a much bigger headspace. Like that's what people are now considering, because all right, well, we solved the border security problem. Now this is really a deportation debate. Now, with that said, I think a lot hinges, I think, both with tariffs and on the deportation side, is how far do you actually go, right, in that process? And what are the, does it feel like, I think you can have large-scale deportations if it feels like this is an orderly process. It feels like this is happening with the minimum of fuss that can actually happen, that there aren't any bad images on television that people are responding to. That's easier said than done.
Right. That is the final question I wanted to ask you, just about the economy. You know, if you think about low propensity voters, the issue that is most likely to be salient for them in any election is going to be how they feel about the economy. And you know, one thing we saw in 2024 was the fact that Donald Trump, no matter how people felt about him personally, voters were like, look, I think he's going to do a better job on the economy, and he's good at that. Like, he's not good at everything, but he's good when it comes to the economy. And now, as you said, there's a lot of anxiety out here, both in the consumers are feeling it, right? We see it in the consumer data. We also are seeing it in the polling data in terms of approval rating of Trump on the economy. What does that mean for, again, these voters? One, we're thinking about them as 2026 voters, but more important, who they see as the party that's going to bring them success economically. And I think Democrats assumed for years that they had the corner on that market because they were the working class party and Republicans were the elites. That's now been flipped a bit. But does it get flipped back if what they see 2 years, 4 years out of Trump, that costs really didn't go down that much, and economically they're feeling unstable? How do you think about that?
Look, I think that a flip switch during COVID, where I think are the economic perception. I mean, economic perceptions really, you know, permanent. I don't know if it's permanent or if it's like, you know, that something flipped to where it's just much harder to get good economic perception out of the same economic conditions. Mm-hmm. What you saw in Trump's first term, and I think that there was probably a lot of hope, right, that he would kind of do this again, is that immediately upon him taking office in 2017, voter perception of the economy just skyrocketed, even though nothing really happened.
Right,
because there was this perception, right, of Trump as this businessman or whatever, you know, exactly what you said about, you know, he owns this issue. This is his can do, fix it type of issue. What you've definitely seen, right, in the first few months is just a lot of, and you know, that's really kind of the scenario, 2017, 2018. Trump wasn't really rocking the boat that much when it came to the economy. He had the tax cut bill. He did some tariffs. mostly in 2018. He hadn't really done much tariff stuff by this point. He is just much more in there, right, doing stuff.
That's right.
And I think that when voters get the sense of, you know, oh my God, he's messing around again. He's doing something to mess around again, either the Liberation Day tariffs. When there's that sense, his approval rating goes down by a couple of points. When he's sort of less in, not in the news as much, rating kind of tends to bounce back up. But still kind of, the number is still pretty close. But I think that's the pattern we've seen. And so what we've seen right now is Trump just doing a lot of stuff. And you have a, let's say, status quo, let's say, de facto risk-averse electorate reacting negatively a little bit. And the question is going to be, June of next year, in the middle of next year, after a lot of the stuff hopefully has settled down,
yep.
What's the outcome? Obviously, what we're seeing now is you saw a huge fear back in April. The United States was going back to recession. And now it's like, nope, not really, not happening.
Right.
Still threatening tariffs, but the market is above, you know, where it was on April 2nd. It's reaching all-time highs. So the question is, can Trump, I think, get that halo effect he had back that he had in his first term? It's going to be harder, though, because I think there's just something psychologically about the American voter that has flipped when it comes to these economic perceptions. I think Democrats were done in by this in 2024. And the question is, I think it's proven a little bit harder for Trump than it was in his first term to drive those perceptions in a positive way. So the question is, what's the result, right? What's going to be the end outcome, the result of these policies?
Right.
I think that's what's going to matter at the end of the day. And I don't think we'll know until, going to start to know until spring, summer of next year. When it comes to the midterms, yeah.
That's a really, really smart point. I've also wondered, I'd love to get your take on this. My theory has been that I don't think people appreciate both COVID, but also the shock to the system that inflation was, and that we had not witnessed anything like that in 40 years. So if you were anybody under the age of 60, this was a brand new experience for you to see prices move like this. And it doesn't just go away overnight, right? You don't just say, oh, okay, well, technically, inflation has slowed. I think there's a perception by a lot of folks that what they expect to see when they hear inflation has slowed is that prices are going to go back to the way they were, that we're going to go back to what my rent cost in 2020. We're going to go back to what the burrito at Chipotle was in 2020. And that's never, we know, right, that doesn't happen. Is that is that a fair way to think about this as well? Is just we're not really appreciating the impact that 2 years of inflation had on the American consumer?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was something that did in the Biden administration, you know, created this real permanent break in this disillusionment. Even if generally speaking, right, people are making more money to compensate. Yep. And if that burrito goes down by 20%, right, are you going to get 20% richer overnight? That's not likely. If that ever happened, that would be, you know, we'd be talking about landslide proportions, right, for one party or another, but that doesn't seem to be in the cards. But that's the risk, right, that I think that, you know, that the Trump folks need to appreciate a little bit more is, like, you got elected, particularly by this multiracial coalition, this younger electorate, based on a deep sense of insecurity that they had. And I think you need to do something visible to communicate something about things have changed. You know, we have pressed the reset button and we are now in a new economic and political era. I think that's what needed to really happen in a really strong way after 2024. I will give credit to Mamdani, right? I mean, that ad that he did, or that video he did with the halal cart,
yep,
and say make halal $8 again. I think Trump should have done, first thing he should have done after the election, is gone to the CEO of McDonald's and said, and browbeat them, cut your, you know, price on, you know, your value meal price or something, right? To just create this symbolic thing that he could point to, right? I gave you a lot of free publicity during the campaign. So do this and we'll make the, you know, we'll make the cost of a value meal $5 again. That was something that Mamdani did very, you know, I think very, it was very deft in a way that I think cut across, I think ideological, and sort of his ideological base. But I think Trump has not been as interested, right? I mean, he benefited clearly from the inflation issue because I think he was just not the other guy. He wasn't the guy who presided over it. But I think it's pretty clear that he hasn't been the sort of candidate who I think is really deeply interested in that issue. In the same way, I think it's a lot of people in DC really haven't been. I don't think they really understood how to harness it.
Right. This has been a fantastic conversation, Patrick. I really appreciate you spending all this time. We're obviously going to be checking in a lot. We can't wait for the addendum to Party of the People. When does that come out?
It comes out in November, one year after the election.
Okay. Okay. We're going to get a lot more great insight from you. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman.